Please be seated. This is the Southern panel on Associate Chief Justice Michael Cherry, Justice Perigary, Justice Stiglitz. We compose the Southern panel. Our first case today is case number 70530, Bobby Richards versus State. Deborah Westbrook for the appellant, Mr. Giacomo for the respondent. Are you ready to proceed? And did you want to reserve any time?
3 minutes.
Okay, I'll keep an eye on the clock.
May it please the court. I'm Deborah Westbrook from the Clark County Public Defender's Office on behalf of the appellant, Bobby Richards. Bobby Richards was convicted of savagely beating his estranged wife, Bronwyn, to death with a deadly weapon in the early morning hours of April 16, 2010. Bobby has always maintained that he's innocent of this crime and that he was at his girlfriend, Kim Williams' house when Bronwyn was attacked at 5:40 in the morning. Unfortunately, there were multiple highly prejudicial errors in this case that deprived Bobby of his right to a fair trial, and it prevented the jury from adequately considering his alibi defense. First, you have the admission of an unduly prejudicial prior bad act that became the focal point of the state's case, the bat rape incident. Then you have the trial court failing to give the mandatory Tavares instruction before four different witnesses testified over a four-day period about the bat rape incident. Then you have the state eliciting inadmissible opinion of guilt testimony from Bronwyn's friend that she knew Bobby murdered Bronwyn because of the bat rape incident. You even have the state arguing in closing that Bobby got away with the bat rape and that based on the bat rape incident alone, the jury could convict Bobby of murder. He adopted the opinion of guilt testimony that was given at the trial impermissibly. In addition to the bat rape errors, you've got the state relying on evidence that was lost or destroyed while it was in the state's possession to argue that Bobby entered and exited Kim Williams' gated community during two gaps in a video recording of the Clear River Gate to that community. You also have the state doctoring a demonstrative exhibit prepared by the state's forensic DNA expert to make it appear as though Bobby's DNA was found at the scene of the crime where he'd been lying in wait for Bronwyn. There are other areas, but these are the primary ones that I want to discuss today because they worked in tandem to unfairly undermine Bobby's fair trial and to unfairly undermine his alibi defense. And I want to start with the issue that the panel permitted supplemental briefing on, and that's the fact that the state relied on evidence that had been lost or destroyed to argue an inference of guilt at trial. The evidence at issue in this case is a hard drive that at one time contained surveillance video for the entire day of April 16, 2010, when Bronwyn was murdered. The contents of that hard drive were accessible before police impounded it into evidence in May of 2010, but when the parties tried to access the hard drive contents 4 years later, in September of 2014, the surveillance video was inaccessible. So without question, the state failed to preserve the hard drive itself. The hard drive is now unreadable and unusable. Now, the state has tried to distract the court from the fact that it failed to preserve the hard drive. And in its answer to my supplemental brief, they make a big deal about the fact that copies were made of the hard drive in 2011 and that Bobby's trial attorney had a copy for 3 years and misplaced it. But the state conveniently left out the fact that you had to have a special machine to view the copies and you had to have a security key in order to access the copies on that machine. And neither of those things were available during the 3 year period that Bobby had this, this copy.
What do you mean it wasn't available?
The state didn't have it. It was apparently in the possession of Kathleen Misak. It was on the property. So there was this copy that was made, and the copy was made before the reader or security key were available to the state. There's actually an interesting, Mr. Giacomo gave a really good explanation of what happened, and it's in the record, volume 6 at page 1302. And he tells the court, my understanding from my IT people is that the nature of the security device on the hard drive is if you don't physically have that reader that she brought us, meaning Kathleen Misak, with the key turned on the reader, that information cannot be read from those hard drives. So when we copied them in the past, that's the reason none of us could access it. You had to have the original drives with the original reader with the key in order to do it with the security features. So we never had any of that stuff during the three-year period that we supposedly had access to this hard drive. And the interesting thing, too, is when the hard drive was copied, it was copied without access to the machine. It was copied without the security key. So we don't even know whether any of the material actually transferred from the hard drive onto the copy.
But does that mean nobody tried to open it for 3 years?
So I understand that Patty had tried to open it, and she approached the district attorney's office and tried to sit down with their IT department. They weren't able to do it. And this all came up at a pretrial right before the case was supposed to go to trial in 2014. And that was when Ms. Erickson told the DA, hey, I misplaced my copy. Can I get a new copy? At that point, the state actually said, we didn't keep any copies. We don't have copies, but we'll try to help you get into the original.
But let me ask you this. If it was that critical to the case, wouldn't you have tried to open it prior to, right before trial?
She did. She wasn't able to open it.
When?
2012. It's in the record. There's Ms. Erickson had prepared a chronology of what had happened in discovery, and it's in the record at pages 503 to 506. It's her chronology of discovery requests and disclosures, and it shows that she made efforts during that entire 3-year period to try and get with the state to get to access the copy of the hard drive, and she wasn't able to do it. And it wasn't until right before that first trial setting in 2014 that it became apparent to everybody that, oh, we needed to have the security key. So at that point, again, like I said, she asked them for it, and the state represented to her at that time that they didn't keep any copies. Mm-hmm. Well, we actually, and here, this is the other thing, too. When she filed her motion, a motion in limine based on the missing hard drive about a year later, the state never said anything about having copies. They threw it back on us, and they said, you had a copy, you could have accessed it.
Okay.
But there's a very important fact that the state's also leaving out, and that's the fact that during trial, Mr. DiGiacomo actually admitted that the state had a copy this whole time, and that the state never turned it over, and the state never tried to access it. And this came up, in the middle of the testimony of Ms. Erickson's forensic expert, and her expert, Mr. DiGiacomo was cross-examining the expert and asking him, well, why didn't you try it with Patty's copy? Did you ever try it with her copy? And he said, no. So Judge Scotty brought the parties up to the bench, and he wanted to know point blank, is there a copy? Is there a copy in evidence? And Mr. DiGiacomo said, no, there's no copy in evidence. But he also said, this is in volume 13 of the appendix at page 3143, lines 20 to 22. And this is where, after he tells Judge Scotty that Patty Erickson had received a copy of the hard drive, he admits, quote, we had one copy. We've never asked anybody to try the hardware with the copy. So the state apparently, they never told us in response to our motion in limine that they had a copy. They never mentioned it, at any point until the middle of trial. So what you're left with, if they're trying to say that this copy somehow exonerates them from losing or destroying the original hard drive, you're either left with, okay, if the copy is accessible, if somehow their copy is readable, then it's a Brady violation because they didn't turn over evidence when Patty asked for it. If it's not accessible, then you have missing evidence. You have this hard drive. So really, at the end of the day, this is about the hard drive itself. The hard drive itself is not readable.
Got it. And I think on this issue, I pretty much, at least I'm pretty comfortable with this issue. Would you do something before you run out of time, and that's address the DNA issue?
The DNA issue.
Yeah.
Okay, so the DNA, there was a forensic expert that the state put on. And the forensic expert, Julie Marshner, she testified about evidence that had been gathered from a chair that had been sitting in the courtyard. And the chair had been, they noticed it because the chair apparently was pushed back. They took a swab from it. Julie looked at that evidence and was unable to form any conclusive opinion about who the DNA came from. And she specifically said all of the items that are listed, in red in her report, those are items that are below our reporting threshold. I can't say that it's him. She was unable to say that it was Bobby. The state, in their closing argument, put up that exhibit, the same exhibit that she had presented during trial, circled a bunch of these red alleles that Julie had said were not, we can't say it's him, and then the district attorney told them, that's him, he was there. I mean, that's huge because he had an alibi defense. And when you're putting him at the scene of the crime, despite the alibi defense, you pretty much eviscerate, you eviscerate that defense. So it was highly prejudicial, despite the fact that Ms. Erickson failed to object. I mean, it's you know, the state cannot be doctoring evidence and passing it off as legitimate in front of the court and in front of the jury. So let's see. I wanted to also talk about you know, the issue of the bat rape itself and the problems with the bat rape. And so prior to trial, the state indicated that it wanted to admit this bat rape evidence, and the court ruled that it was admissible under two cases, Hogan versus State and Lamb versus State, and that it was relevant to show ill will as a motive and inferentially identity. But the incident was far too inflammatory to be admissible for the purposes under those cases. And if you look at Hogan was a case where, you know, the bad act was that several days before the killing, Hogan dropped the victim to the ground from shoulder height. And it was already in evidence that he threatened the victim. In Lamb, the bad act was the defendant threatening to bash his sister's head in. And his defense was that somebody else killed her, somebody else had a motive to kill her. So it was particularly relevant in that case for the state to be able to say, well, he also had a motive to kill her, because you're balancing competing motives. This was an alibi case. There was no, you know, we weren't trying to pin the crime on a specific person, and there was no real issue of who was more likely to be the killer than not. And when you consider the evidence that came in those trials, it was so minor compared to what came in here. The jury heard here, a few weeks before Bronwyn's death, Bobby waited in the courtyard for her to return home, threatened her with a baseball bat, pushed her into the house and into her bedroom, threw her on the bed, ripped her panties off, smelled them, raped her, and told her to look into his eyes and tell him that she loved him. And that's overkill, particularly where the state already had three bad acts, you know, a choking incident, a smothering incident, and an incident where the state tried to keep, Bobby tried to keep her from leaving the house.
How did the judge instruct the jury on the bad act?
So the judge instructed the jury that it just generally, at the time of the instructions. The judge didn't instruct the jury at any point prior to the testimony as was required under Tavares. So these four witnesses all came in, you know, there were three on a Friday. Three of them came in on Friday, the 20, let's see, what day was it?
So there were no limiting instructions.
Yeah, there were no limiting. So Friday the 19th, they heard from Deborah Ramos, they heard from Dacia Dixon, they heard from Erica Johnson, and Erica Johnson was the one who said, you know, because of the bat rape, I know he did it. Then they had an entire weekend to sit on it. Then on Monday, is that my
3 minutes?
Go and finish your thought.
So then on Monday, they heard from a new witness. And the Tavares instruction that was read didn't get read until the following Friday. And at the point that it was read, the state actually made arguments that were contrary to the instruction. They argued propensity, they argued modus operandi that were not in the instruction. So, you know, even though, I mean, basically the Tavares instruction that was given was too little too late under the circumstances of the case, and given the way all of the evidence interacted with it, with you know, all the other pieces.
If we did find it to be error, why isn't it harmless, though, in this particular case?
The jury
didn't believe the alibi, it looks like.
Part of the reason they didn't believe the alibi was because the state got up there and said that he entered and exited the gated community during those two gaps in the video, okay? Prior to trial, Mr. DiGiacomo actually represented to Judge Silver that that 1.5 hour period, that was exculpatory because you don't see him coming and going at any point until after the crime. So the way that this evidence was used, this woman, Kathleen Misak, came to the conclusion that those two gaps meant something based on her review of evidence that we don't have. And you know, Mr. DiGiacomo represented in closing that, you know, essentially told the jury, wink, wink, nod, nod. That's when he got in and out of the community. So that's why, you know, otherwise he had the alibi.
I'm going to give you your 3 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. DiGiacomo, I'm going to give you 16 minutes instead of 15.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court, my name is Mark DiGiacomo. I represent the state of Nevada in this appeal. I want to start with the video, particularly the statement I made about one copy. The one copy I'm talking about is the original drives. And the court needs to understand what happens. As with any surveillance system, there's a unique drive that can run that surveillance system. The detectives request from the HOA an hour and a half time period, from 6 a.m. to 5:30 a.m., or sorry, from 5 a.m. to 6:30 a.m. from both entrances. And they get a CD copy of that, which the defense has. It is during that time period where they can't find the cars coming in and out that they ask this woman to review to see if other cars might have come out, because Mr. Richards drove an SUV back to the crime scene, but it's likely he drove his mistress's daughter's white Honda to the crime to commit the crime. When she's doing that, she realizes, hey, I'm getting a lot of cars coming in multiple times that I never see going out. And so there's a problem with our camera system. And when you look at the video, there's no question there's a problem with the camera system because it's a motion sensor, but the wind sets it off. And so most of the time you're just looking at leaves, and every once in a while you see a car come through until you hit a 10-minute gap in the middle of the video. And so the detective, being a good detective, and he's getting in trouble for this, says, look, I don't know what's going on. I'm going to collect the two hard drives. And there's this whole discussion about the cases. The hard drives are regular hard drives. Get them at Amazon. They're 250 megabyte hard drives. In order for you to play the hard drive on their system or for their system to record to the hard drive, there's a physical case that goes on the outside that plugs into the outside of a regular hard drive that allows it to then be pushed into the server so that the server can write to the hard drive and that the reader can read from the hard drive. The detective gives those two cases back to the HOA so they can replace their hard drives. In fact, he buys them two hard drives so they can replace it. It's all on the record. Starts about 510 and goes through about 570. He takes the hard drives. He puts the hard drives in evidence. The defense says, we want to copy the hard drives. They make a copy of the hard drives. It doesn't matter what hard drive you have. You could have that hard drive. You could have a copy of the hard drive. You could have 10 copies of the hard drive. When you go back, you have to get the physical case that goes on the hard drive and plug it into the reader in order to see it. We never looked at it. Why? Because Mr. Richards says, and he has a witness that says he's home at 5:05 in the morning, and he has a witness that says, I see him leaving the house at 6:08 in the morning. And so those two time periods, the 5 to 6:30 is the only relevant time period for the state. And the cameras just did not capture all of that time period. To suggest that they actually wanted this evidence suppressed, if this evidence was suppressed, well, then you'd have no evidence of who came in and out. They were using the video to say, look, he must have never left because we don't see him going in and out of the gate, when the evidence indicates that there's major gaps and you can't draw that conclusion from the evidence. So when Ms. Erickson in 2014 said, I lost my prior copies, if she had had those prior copies, you could have put them on the physical case and slid them into the unit and watched it. We made another copy for her. When she couldn't look at those, we got her the originals, but we're not talking about the relevant time period because we have the relevant time period preserved between 5 and 6:30. The time period that's not preserved is before 5 and after 6:30, and the state never introduced any evidence related to anything on any of those drives outside of the 5 to 6:30 CD that was, in fact, downloaded, provided, and admitted into evidence.
Mr. DiGiacomo, can I switch gears a little bit unless you want to still hear about the video? Just three areas I'd like you to address. One, the court's failure to give the Tavares limiting instruction timely.
Correct.
Two, in closing, both the DNA arguments that you presented to the jury, as well as the kind of suggestion to the jury that if the police had looked more, they would have found more evidence. Like those, yeah,
sure.
that comes. If you could address those things for me, I'd
sure.
be great.
And let me start with the Tavares instruction. Uh-huh. I looked long and hard to see if there was an affirmative waiver of the Tavares instruction at the time of the witnesses as required under McClellan. I can't find it. So I will have to confess that it is error. But then you go to what is the effect of that error in this particular case. And as McClellan sort of suggests, when the evidence is as overwhelming as it is in this particular case, it would be harmless. Now, that instruction was given to the jury in its closing. In the final jury instructions and under Richardson v. March, juries are presumed to follow those instructions. But what you have to remember is not only do you have the bad acts, not only do you have his own son saying, I heard him beating his mother, but you also have blood in his wallet on a card that goes to a car wash, And then there's a floor mat that was in Tatiana's car and removed that morning by Tatiana and placed in the trash can under the sink, which is covered in Bronwyn's blood with a linear blood spot consistent with a cylindrical object being laid on it. All of that together makes this an overwhelming evidence. The only defense that he had was claiming that he was there at 5:05, and then the weird part about the 6:08, when Tatiana looks out that window, he's not in his car. He's actually parking her white car right there at the curb. Now, she thinks it's because he's moving the car to get the SUV out so he can drive away, but the truth of the matter is he's coming back from the crime scene when that happens and is parking the car and then cleaning up to take his SUV and drive back. As it relates to the DNA evidence, you have all seen DNA evidence before. DNA evidence are charts. You know, you're 15, 16, 14, 13, whatever. And then they run that. The suspect's on one side, the unknown evidence is on the other side. And in order for the analyst to draw a conclusion, a reportable conclusion, you have to have numbers that are above a certain threshold. Now, if they're too low, you get a little star and you get nothing. If they're in between the minimum threshold and the reporting threshold, you get a bunch of red numbers. And those red numbers match the defendant in this particular case. Now, the analyst cannot say, because of our reporting requirements, that I can conclusively say that's his DNA. But what she could say was that DNA is consistent with this particular defendant. Now, in our case, the only thing we did was put up the evidence. We put up his
profile.
Isn't
that inconsistent with the expert's testimony? I mean, usually they offer an opinion to a 99.9% certainty.
What's even higher than that, usually?
Right.
Yes, and that's why she could not do the reporting statistics in
right.
the case.
Doesn't that seem inconsistent with arguing, knowing that there can't be an identification to any degree of certainty for this individual? It seems to me to be a little deceptive.
It's not deceptive. It's an inference from the evidence. Yes, the DNA analyst cannot say that that's his DNA to the 1 in 1,200 quintillion.
Right.
But certainly lawyers are allowed to argue the inference from the evidence. The inference was that there's DNA on that chair consistent with...
The expert is there because the jury needs expert testimony to make that determination.
But we instruct juries all the time that says, look, if there are reasons for relying upon it, you're free to reject it. And it's sort of like the same situation with the two pictures and the bat. Yeah, their expert would not give me on cross-examination that clearly that's a bat, but any 12 people looking at those two pictures in the bat can say, yep, that woman was hit with a bat.
Yeah.
That they're free to draw the reasonable inference from the evidence that's presented to them, and there's nothing improper about it. In fact, I've had experts who will testify saying, my lab requires me to have a reporting threshold. I don't meet the reporting threshold, but if I were to drop that reporting threshold, in my opinion, his DNA is there. Now, we didn't go that far in this case. In argument, we just put up the two things saying this is not inconsistent with the defendant being in that particular chair, that it's consistent with. There's nothing inconsistent about this particular piece of evidence.
But you went farther than your expert would go.
Correct.
In closing.
Correct, and that's what lawyers do. We argue what the inferences are from the evidence. What inference can you draw from this evidence? Is it that... he is conclusively identified to, I don't think Ms. Mercer said that. What she said was, look, this chair has moved. They thought the perpetrator sat in this chair. And if you look at that, his profile seems to appear as the DNA on that chair. So it certainly lends to the credence to what Dion says, which is daddy's beaten mommy and that he has been left for him. The other issue that... you sort of suggested is that I made some sort of argument in rebuttal about the defense argued, why didn't they test this particular sink? Mm-hmm. And my response to them was essentially, yeah, had he washed his hands in that sink and there was blood in that sink and they got DNA from it, that would have been inculpatory. But the fact that he had, or if he hadn't washed his hands in the sink, or if there was no DNA recovered from the sink, it doesn't somehow exculpate the defendant in any manner. that the mistake by the police officer from not doing that same doesn't give you information one way or the other was the context of the argument that I was making to the jury. I wasn't suggesting that I wasn't doing any sort of burden shifting. I wasn't doing some sort of inflammatory argument. I was just trying to explain to the jury is, yeah, police officers can make mistakes, but how is that relevant to your determination as to whether or not we proved our case beyond a reasonable doubt or not? There was some reference to, and it's in there, the two things. One is Erica, when she shows up on scene, says, he did it, he did it. Now, that was relevant for a really important reason. When the police first get to the scene, they haven't heard the 911, and they're getting Dion out of the house, and the daughter is down the street, and she's trying to call Dad, and his phone's going to voicemail. They finally get Dion out, but they haven't interviewed him yet, so they have no idea what he says. And so he's off the side when the defendant shows up at the scene, and the defendant is standing there with his daughter, who thinks she's just seen his white car running when she runs away from the murder scene, and his son, who thinks he's just heard his dad beating his mother to death. And they're all standing together for a long period of time. And when she shows up, Erica, she sees the tape, she runs with the police officers, he did it, he did it, he did it. And they're like, who? And she's like, that guy standing next to the two main witnesses in the case. And lo and behold, both witnesses started backing off their stories the moment the police started talking to them. She tells, the daughter tells the son, hey, Dad couldn't have been there because he wasn't there. Well, how did she know that? Well, because Dad just showed up and told her that. And then the son's like, well, no, it wasn't my dad's voice because he wasn't there because my sister told me he wasn't there. So that was highly relevant to why it is the police run over there, separate him, and why it is that they left him there with those two kids who were the main witnesses in the case. The other one is the rape one, and the court should review Judge Silver's ruling as it relates to the rape allegation. There's some quote about how when she wrote it on paper, she didn't think it was highly relevant. When you listen to the witnesses, and what the witnesses say, one, the daughter, who sees her dad holding a baseball bat this morning with the lights out, and she goes back to bed. And then you have the witnesses who describe the event that Bronwyn describes to them with the ripped underwear and the photograph that matches it. This isn't like 3 months ago they got into an argument and there was a minor DV. The crime that occurred here was vicious. It was overwhelmingly violent, and somebody had to have a motive to do that. And she had no enemies, as witnesses were testifying. So who would that be? Well, what do you think it would be? Maybe it's the guy who 9 days before attacked her with a bat, dragged her in her house, and raped her. The motive isn't just motive to do ill will. It's motive to do really bad ill will to Bronwyn Richards. And that was the argument that was being made is, look, DNA evidence was fantastic in this case. The son saying it was good. The daughter, who I think is mistaken, she sees a white car, but I don't think she sees Mr. Richards' white car. I think she sees Tatiana's white car. But all of that evidence together would have convicted him. But the truth of the matter is you don't really understand the motive unless you understand what happened 9 days before. And anybody who has no enemies in the world who gets killed in the courtyard of her home with a blunt object severely beaten her to death, that's somebody who has a lot of rage and anger against the victim. And that evidence, more than any of the other DV evidence that was admitted in this case, that evidence was highly probative. Was it inflammatory? Yes, but was it unduly inflammatory? Not because of the nature of its probative value. The probative value was so overwhelmingly high. I was just looking to see if there was anything else. I think that pretty much covers it. If there's any or no questions from the court.
Any other questions?
I'd submit it.
Just briefly, because I'm going to ask Ms. Westbrook as well. If the court were to find there was unpreserved error that wasn't plain error, can you accumulate those? Is there any authority that suggests that you could accumulate unpreserved, not plain error?
No. I mean, as far as I know, that there isn't any. It'd be one thing if there were a number of objections that somehow the court inappropriately overruled upon, but, you know, not giving the court a chance to correct any error and then, you know, looking to see if it was plain error and then attempting to accumulate that, I don't believe there's any appellate authority for that.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Westbrook, 3 minutes.
Justice Stiglitz, to answer your question, which I believe you posed in the Jeremias case, in that case there was an issue of, you know, multiple errors during different phases of trial, and that was part of the problem because there was a penalty phase error, there were, you know, jury voir dire errors, there were errors at trial. Here, the bulk of the errors went to a single, you know, went to a single issue, being the bat rape. The initial bat rape was preserved. We objected to the introduction of that evidence, and then when it was used at trial, the state kind of went back on what it originally told Judge Silver it was going to do with that evidence. It did something entirely different, argued modus operandi, effectively used the incident of the bat rape to prove that a bat was used in both crimes. And all of the errors related to kind of that same topic. So in that way, I think you are able to accumulate errors when they relate to a single piece of evidence, when they relate to a single theory of the case. And at one point, I looked at the cases cited in Jeremias, and there was the talk. There was a discussion. I think a Sixth Circuit case that said they weren't sure whether you could do it. And there was a circuit split. Some courts say you can. Some courts say that you can't. So I believe there is authority for the proposition that you can accumulate errors, but it really depends on the facts of the case. And this is one of those cases where, because the errors all related, to a very specific, it related to his alibi defense. It related to whether a bat was the murder weapon. It can be accumulated here. So one of the things the state mentions is that the copy that they were mentioning in front of Judge Scotti was they were talking about the hard drive. Well, actually, if you go to the record at page 3143, what Mr. DiGiacomo is talking about are two copies that Chris DeFonseca, an attorney general or employee from the attorney general's office, they're copies that he made. And what Mr. DiGiacomo says is, neither of DeFonseca's copies are in evidence. We never asked DeFonseca to try that hard drive with his copy. He's admitting that DeFonseca, the state attorney general employee, had a copy and that the state had a copy. So when he gets up here and says that their copy was actually the original, that's a misrepresentation. There were copies. The state had a copy. They didn't tell us about it. They didn't turn it over.
Do you think you've made out bad faith, though, in the failure to produce the video in a readable fashion? Do you think that we can infer bad faith somehow?
I think you can infer bad faith from the fact that we filed a motion in limine to exclude the hard drive because it was missing. The state told us in 2014 they didn't keep copies. In their response to our motion in limine to exclude the hard drive evidence, they never told us that they had a copy. That puts us in an untenable position. Either they have a copy, they withhold it, and then they make arguments in closing that are, you know, that we could have refuted if we had the copy.
But you're not suggesting they had a copy that worked.
We don't know. And that's why ultimately the issue of the copy is a red herring, and why the real issue in this case is that the hard drive itself was not preserved.
Thank you, Ms. Westbrook.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Court thanks both counsel for your spirited arguments in this matter and your briefs. This matter will stand submitted.